So, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Heart Sutra Part 2. Those of you who missed last week, please don't worry, because we didn't even make it to the end of the first sentence. We had a long introduction. We made it through the title and almost all the first sentence. So we're going to pick up where we left off, where Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva was deeply practicing Prajnaparamita and clearly saw that all five, and I'm going to say skandhas because I like it better than, as I said last week, aggregate sounds too much like cement. And I like to use the word skandhas. All five skandhas are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So I'm not going to review the five skandhas other than to say that they are sensation, perception, formation, meaning mental formation, and consciousness, and they are a kind of mental model of how the mind works. They don't exist any more than the ego, the id, and the superego exist. They're a schema about, and they exist in relationship to each other. Meaning, of course, that they are empty. Now, this word empty, as we started to talk about last week, has been problematic ever since it was first chosen as a translation for the Sanskrit shunya or shunyata, emptiness. Now, shunya does in fact mean void, hollow, zero. But these words in English tend to have negative associations, right? Emptiness can suggest nihilism, despair, loneliness. And that is not at all the meaning of this Buddhist term. The translator Kaz Ta-Nehisi uses the word boundlessness here. So I suggested last week that you kind of try that out, thinking in terms of boundlessness. I kind of like that translation. It gives a sense of no separate existence, no beginning, no end in time or space, just the arising and passing away of phenomena. So boundlessness is quite possibly an easier word through which to access this sense of what we're calling emptiness. Thich Nhat Hanh, in his commentary, points out that empty really has no meaning unless you know empty of what is empty of what. So the five skandhas, what they're empty of is permanent, separate, distinct existence. They only exist as interrelated functions, constantly in flux. And that's true of us and all other phenomena. So this is an emptiness that is full of possibility. The Japanese Buddhist philosopher Masao Abe says this: precisely because it is emptiness which empties even emptiness. True emptiness is absolute reality which makes all phenomena, all existence truly be. So he suggests that emptiness goes hand in hand with suchness. Have you heard that word, suchness or thusness? It's that sort of instantaneous isness of a phenomena. So Abe says emptiness is suchness or thusness. When we sit in zazen, we have the opportunity to experience the emptiness of the five skandhas directly. I had a rather vivid demonstration of this some years ago, attending a sesshin in Oregon with Zen teacher Jan Chosen Bays. For some reason, I can't recall, Michael maybe can, there was an old-fashioned oil lamp, you know, the kind with a glass chimney, sitting either on the altar or beside the altar on a lower table. And Michael was the timekeeper. And in that tradition, the timekeeper goes up and lights a stick of incense at the beginning of every block of sitting. So it was about halfway through the week. It was early in the morning. It was quite dark. And suddenly the lamp crashed to the floor and the glass chimney smashed into bits. But that's not what I heard. I heard it was as if in slow motion, this musical tinkling as each shard hit the floor. There was no sense of startlement or alarm. But there was a kind of response to the beauty of the sound in me. So remembering the skandhas, there was the form of the lamp crashing. There was my sensation of hearing it. There was my perception of it as actually a beautiful sound. And then came, after that came the mental formation of, oh, that was the lamp crashing. And then after that, oh, I hope Michael's okay. And then the Zendo returned to silence, and the activity of my skandhas returned to silence as well, subsided. So things quiet down enough when we're in retreats, particularly longer retreats, where you can really observe how the mind works. And if we truly understand the emptiness of the five skandhas, we'll realize that there is nothing to hold on to, nothing to push away. And we're released from our suffering, just like Avalokiteshvara. There seems to be some ambiguity in those final words, was saved from all suffering, in different versions. Some versions say Avalokiteshvara was saved from all suffering, and some use the active form and say Avalokiteshvara relieved all suffering, as though, you know, relieving suffering of other beings. Some versions leave that phrase out because it doesn't apparently appear in any Sanskrit versions, only in the Chinese versions. But really, regardless, Avalokiteshvara's freedom from suffering is our freedom from suffering. And ours is our neighbor's. If I'm able to see the emptiness of my conditioned defensive reactions to my neighbor and not generate retaliatory words or actions I might otherwise have engaged in, both I and my neighbor are freed from suffering. For a while, anyway. So this is something you can observe directly in your everyday life and in practice. The emptiness of the five skandhas does not have to be an abstract concept. In fact, I don't know, those of you who are here remember the example of the parent and the child being stung by a bee in the garden. So if you find yourself saying to that child, don't cry, that bee is just an illusion, that bee's just empty, then I would say you've gone too far. And you've become attached to the concept of emptiness. So the next passage is an antidote to that, an antidote to going too far into the concept of emptiness. And we're going to look at that. We're going to look at form itself as emptiness and emptiness itself form. But first, just to make sure that you get a chance this time to talk, I'm going to pause right here and not wait till I get done. And I'm going to ask you, I asked those of you who were here last week to kind of go home and observe your five skandhas. So maybe you have. Maybe you have consciously, and maybe you have not so consciously. But I'd like you to divide into three threes, like 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3. And each of you just speak for a couple of minutes each about how seeing deeply into the emptiness of the five skandhas can relieve you of suffering. You may have an example, or you maybe can imagine an example. But see if you can make it specific, you know, something you actually have experienced or can imagine experiencing. Make it less abstract. So let's just take, you know, about 10 minutes. Each of you take a couple of minutes, and then we'll come back and I'll say some more about the next passage, okay? So go ahead and just cluster yourselves, introduce yourselves, say your name. Can you pause? So let's move on to the next sentence, which goes, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form, form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. I'm going to digress first to take note of Shariputra and what he's doing here. Shariputra was one of the Buddha's original disciples. He's often paired with his friend since childhood, Moggallana. They were said not only to have been born on the same day, but to have been conceived on the same day. They were not relatives, but they were their families were close. And they became disciples of the Buddha together as young men. And after decades of practice in the Sangha, they both died shortly before the Buddha did. Moggallana was reputed to be the greatest of the disciples in terms of spiritual power. He had many extrasensory powers. And Shariputra was said to be the greatest in terms of wisdom. So that's how he comes to be chosen to receive this teaching from Avalokiteshvara. Because it's the teaching of Prajnaparamita, wisdom beyond wisdom. Now there may be another reason why he was chosen, and this comes from the translator Red Pine in his commentary. The story goes that when the Buddha's mother Maya died a week after giving birth to the baby Buddha to be, she was not reborn as in the human realm, but she went to abide in a heavenly realm at the summit of Mount Sumeru, which is an immense mythical mountain at the center of the world. She lived there among devas, or heavenly beings, and she became a deva herself, called Santushta. Years later, the Buddha, having given many different teachings, usually of a very pragmatic nature. You know, the Buddha was a real pragmatist. He didn't indulge in metaphysics much at all. In fact, he often refused to answer metaphysical questions. And he would say, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. But he wanted to teach the Abhidharma, or the highest Dharma. It's a kind of model of the construction of the mind, very complex. And he felt it was too difficult for ordinary human beings. So he went up to Mount Sumeru, and he taught Santushta, his former mother, now a deva. And he spent an entire rainy season, that would be 3 months, typically, doing that. But once a day, he would come down to earth, and he would teach Shariputra, his most talented, intellectually gifted disciple. He would teach Shariputra a kind of condensed version of the teachings he was giving Santushta. And so Shariputra memorized this teaching, and that became, once it was written down, the Abhidharma section of the Pali Canon, of the original, or the earliest written teachings. And back in the heavenly realm, Santushta advanced to the next stage on the path to enlightenment. She didn't make it all the way, but she made progress, apparently. So this is a mythical story. And Red Pine, in his commentary, makes the conjecture that in the Heart Sutra, it is Santushta, Buddha's mother, who appears as Avalokiteshvara, because she's the one who can give the true understanding of the Abhidharma to Shariputra, to counter the misinterpretations of this sect called the Sarvastivadins, which I mentioned last week, who were teaching that entities do have a discrete, permanent existence. In other words, that they are not boundless and empty. So this was a kind of corrective teaching. And it's not for me to judge his interpretation, how far-fetched that is, because I'm no scholar. But I find it a moving story that the Buddha goes to find his mother and give her his most difficult teaching. Because, after all, unless we had very extraordinary parents, our deep wish is for our parents to be free from suffering, isn't it? For our parents to be awakened, so that they can give us the compassion and unconditional love that we so yearn for from them. So I think there's something very kind of archetypal about the Buddha, who lost his mother very, very early in life, still remembering her and wanting to free her. And it's also rather poignant that she would manifest as the Bodhisattva compassion, a Bodhisattva of compassion, to come help him set the record straight, get this teaching out. There is a slightly longer version of the Heart Sutra. It hasn't become the prevailing version, but there is another, a slightly longer version that begins with the Buddha sitting in meditation on Vulture Peak among his disciples. Vulture Peak was a place where the Buddha often taught. And at the moment the Buddha enters very deep samadhi, Avalokiteshvara sees that all five skandhas are empty. And Shariputra asks Avalokiteshvara, if any noble son or daughter were to practice the deep practice of Prajnaparamita, how should they be instructed? And so this is Avalokiteshvara's answer to Shariputra, what comes next. Form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. And that was a very long time before quantum physicists taught us about particles and waves not differing. Pretty remarkable, eh? The metaphor of the sea and waves is often used. Waves arise and subside from the sea, right? But they're not separate from the sea. Or from each other, except as temporary manifestations. As George Leonard said, there's only the dance. We must not get stuck in form or in emptiness. If we do, we can't dance. We must follow what the great early Mahayana Buddhist philosopher Nagarjuna called the middle way between form and emptiness. One of the commentaries that Red Pine quotes says, "Ordinary people can't conceive of emptiness without eliminating form. Bodhisattvas, regardless of the phenomena, understand that form and emptiness share the same body." Form and emptiness share the same body. So we don't have to understand emptiness by negating form. Form and emptiness share the same body. So Avalokiteshvara goes on. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this, meaning both empty, boundless, and manifesting, always manifesting. So these are our five skandhas. He begins, or she, Avalokiteshvara, we'll call her she, by talking about form is not different from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form, and you could repeat that for each of the other four skandhas. Form is the first. And so you could then say, sensations do not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from sensations. And then go on to each of the other skandhas. The skandhas are boundless and only exist as they manifest in interrelationship with each other. So that's what you're kind of, even though, you know, it's really hard to kind of piece them apart and say, well, there was that skandha and there was that skandha. We can feel them. We can kind of directly experience how they co-arise. That's a word that's used, co-arise. So next, Avalokiteshvara expands the statement even further. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. All dharmas, they neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So one thing to note here is the word dharma is being used differently from the way we usually use it. We usually think of dharma meaning the teachings of the Buddha, right? Or the law, the ultimate truth. Here it means phenomena, manifestations. So all dharma means, all dharmas mean all phenomena. So every phenomenon in the universe is marked by emptiness, or we could say is boundlessly interconnected. And then come these three pairs of statements. All dharmas neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Dharmas appear to arise and cease, but from the perspective of boundlessness, there is no birth, no death. Impermanence too is empty, boundless. So the emptiness of emptiness. So to tweak Einstein, dharmas are neither created nor destroyed. Defilement and purity describe states of, so defilement would be states of suffering and delusion. Purity would be freedom from suffering. And of course, We don't want the former and we want the latter. But in the light of Prajnaparamita, wisdom beyond wisdom, there is no such duality. Dharmas cannot be purified, they cannot be defiled. There's just the flow, the dance. And at the same time, there are harmful actions, there are beneficial actions, and we need to be able to know the difference. Form is no different from emptiness. Emptiness no different from form. And then the things that we want and don't want do seem to increase and decrease. But in the wisdom of boundlessness, there is no gain, no loss. No self-existence that can have more or less, or that can be more or less. So maybe this wisdom beyond wisdom can help us not to grasp so desperately to what we want to hang on to, and not to run away so desperately from what we want to get away from. So I'm going to suggest a mindfulness practice for this coming week. And it's to notice whenever self-clinging arises, whenever you catch yourself making a separation between self and other, me and not me, mine and not mine. And you might notice that causes a certain suffering, dukkha, dissatisfaction. And so your mindfulness practice is when you notice that happening, to just pause and breathe and say, no self, no other. Or no mine, no not mine. You could also, you could do this, and I've given you this on your, this is your crib sheet, your Heart Sutra crib sheet here. If you look on the back of it, you see the eight worldly dharmas. The eight worldly dharmas are pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disgrace, or disrepute. And they're sometimes called the eight winds, because we're always being blown back and forth between them, right? We want praise and we don't want blame. Oh my gosh, I just got some praise, that's so great. Oh, I hate being blamed. And then, now you're plummeting again. So these are the eight winds. So you might notice when you're being blown in one of those eight winds and stop and say, no praise, no blame. That's one I use, you know, because it's, I think blame is a really hard one, isn't it? Nobody likes to be blamed, particularly when it feels really unfair. No loss, no gain. So maybe this, you know, when you go, this coming week, just notice whenever you're aware of one of those splits arising, and just stop and say, you know, no praise, no blame, no me, no you, and just see what happens. You don't have to know, you don't have to analyze it. Just stop and say it, and please don't bludgeon yourself with this. Okay, it's please do it with the compassion of Avalokiteshvara. Okay, so that's as far as we'll go for this week, and next week we'll move on to no eyes, no ears, no nose, no body, no mind. Because that's the really fun part.